stato lì che a Genù. You don't forget to say I sing you. I sing you say I go open my mouth like basket you. My land will be akbere. Basket mouth won't start to leak again. Forget to say I sing you. I sing you say I go open my mouth like a basket to you. My land will be a quere. Basket mouth won't start to leak again.
That's Fela Anikulapokuti of Nigeria, the late multi-instrumentalist, musician, composer, and pioneer of what is today known as Afrobeat, with Beasts of No Nation. That was the title track of the album released in 2009. He died in Lagos, Nigeria, on August the 2nd, 1997, at the age of 58. This is Lead Stories. I'm Retrace Lead. It is Tuesday, April the 7th, and two stories we'll be tackling today. In the second half of the program, we'll be talking about badges, bullets, and bodies, police killings at an all-time high. That's in the second half of our program, but first, we're going to go to Nigeria. Former military strongman Muhammadu Buhari, Nigeria's president-elect, rode the crest of popular support for his campaign promise to rout both Boko Haram terrorists and rampant government corruption from the continent's most populous nation. But as he forms his transition team and selects key members of his administration, which officially begins on May the 29th, Buhari is already warning his countrymen not to expect miracles. Buhari's political triumph is being hailed as a new start, not only for Nigeria, but also for the region and the continent as a whole. Is there reason to believe that the former major general who led a coup in 1983 that brought him to power and whose regime racked up more than a fair share of human rights abuses, is now a born-again Democrat? Our guest, Dr. Chika Onyani, the Nigerian-born publisher and editor-in-chief of the New York-based African Sun-Times, is here with us today to offer his analysis of Buhari's return to power and its potential impact on the war-ravaged region. And Dr. Onyani, always a pleasure to talk with you, and I'm delighted that you could join us today.
Thank you so much, Utrecht, for inviting me.
Well, I know that the African Sun-Times has been writing about this. What is your story this week? Let's start there about Buhari.
Well, we just published I wrote, which is Goodluck Jonathan, the change agent that Africa needed now. And this is as a result of what the president of Nigeria, that is Goodluck Jonathan, what he did after the election, before the result of the election was announced, he picked up the phone and, he tried to reach Buhari many times. He couldn't, and eventually he had to call somebody where Buhari was and sent his emissary there to tell Buhari that he was trying to reach him, you know, because if he had not reached him, he wouldn't have conceded. And so eventually Buhari was told that Jonathan was trying to reach him, and he to pick up the phone the next time the phone rang, and he did. And Jonathan congratulated him and conceded. And what that did was to immediately lower the temperature in the country, you know, as a whole in Africa, because Africans were calling me, ambassadors were calling me, asking me what was going on in Nigeria, and thanking me for updating the website about the results and all, and that, because every African was holding his breath in anxiety, especially since the CIA had forecast that Nigeria would break up in 2015. This is this year. And so what Jonathan did, as I said, is a courageous act, because he did not even consult with his advisors. He did not consult with his party people. He just said, this is something I want to do. So in essence, Buhari won the election, but it is Jonathan who has taken the glory.
Well, just the same, there's a transition going on now. Good Luck Jonathan would be out as of May the 29th. Buhari would be in officially with the reins of the country in his hands. You know more than just about anybody what that is supposed to mean. As May 29th approaches, and given the history that you are familiar with Buhari as a military strongman, I have to ask, in this election, did we see, in terms of the overwhelming support for Buhari, did we see, in effect, an expression by Nigerians for a longing for the days where somebody strong will be in government, and it didn't matter whether that person had previous stint at power as a result of a coup, but that this was the kind of guy you need just at a time like this? Or was it something else? Was he able to convince Nigerians that he was or is, in fact, as he describes himself now, a changed man? What does it mean to you as May the 29th approaches and the new regime begins its tenure?
Unlike Republicans who wish Obama to fail, I wish that Buhari will succeed in being a successful president. But Yatris, we have to understand when you look at the results of the election, you know, Buhari won. He had 15.4 million votes, and Jonathan had 12.8 million votes. That's a difference of 2.75 million votes. Now, when you look at how did that happen, you look at Kano. Kano gave Buhari 1.9 million votes as against 215,000 votes for Jonathan. And Jigawa, Katsina, Sokoto, they gave Buhari 3 million votes against 300,000 votes for Jonathan. So, really, Buhari did not get in the southeast, Buhari did not get up to 400,000 votes. In the south, he did not get up to 400,000 votes. And in the southwest, because of the fact that he had a running mate from the southwest. He did better. He got about 1.5 million votes. So in essence, this is a divided country, because he got like 2.5 million votes or so, 2.3 million votes in the south. The other 13 million votes he got it from the north. The same thing with Jonathan. Jonathan did not get more than 1.2 million votes in the whole north.
Well, so, what you're referring to here, this division that you're referring to, is along religious lines. Jonathan being Christian. And from the south, and Buhari being Muslim and from the north. And you explained before in previous programs that you've been here, you've been talking about this north-south arrangement that has been going on for so long. And along, we're seeing now more and more the lines drawn along religion. And this brings me to the question, with Buhari coming in as a Muslim and terror and terrorism, he says, are in his crosshairs, and he's going to go after the terrorists with all that he has, and in a way that is a direct slap at Jonathan, who was seen as being a bit way too hesitant to deal with the issue. Do you think that In effect, this too is part of the claim by Buhari that he is a changed man? He's really not the despot of the 80s. He is a man who is interested in advancing the cause of justice in Nigeria.
I just posted an article in Al Jazeera, said that people are afraid. There is the fear that Buhari has not changed in terms of how he muscled the Nigerian press when he came into power, jailing people who tried to write anything about return to democracy. I am not the right person to ask about Buhari's change, because I don't. I'm not somebody who believes that he has changed, because really, Nigerians wanted anybody. You know, as people have said, whatever his name was, they would have voted for the person other than Jonathan. And the question about Boko Haram, the Buhari dealing with Boko Haram, I have said it many times that northern leaders, you know, they are the ones who brought on Boko Haram, especially Buhari himself, who Nigerians have forgotten last year, I mean in 2013, said that an attack on Boko Haram is an attack on the whole North. People have forgotten that in fact, Jonathan being weak was as a result of Northern leaders saying that the military. Which was then under a southern general, was committing genocide by going after Boko Haram. We should not forget those things. And Jonathan's reticence in going after Boko Haram was a result of these things that these attacks on the operations of the Nigerian military that the northern leaders had been expressing. And we have to understand who were the people who were funding Boko Haram. How did the ragtag army begin to acquire all this heavy weaponry? How were they able to acquire all kinds of things to fight the military? Who were providing them with the money?
Could you answer your own question, Dr. Onyani?
Mm-hmm.
Could you answer that question?
Well, as I said, northern leaders were the ones who were funding them. And if all of a sudden, as somebody just wrote today, Buhari will be inheriting a Boko Haram that has already been decimated, because in the 6 weeks that the election was postponed, the Nigerian military then undertook to confront Boko Haram the way they should have been confronted. And we haven't in the last 6 weeks heard of Boko Haram capturing any village, even a village. They haven't. They are on the run. So that is the kind of Boko Haram that Buhari will be inheriting. And we have to look at Buhari from 1983. When Nigeria had 13 years of military rule until 1979, Obasanjo, who was the military dictator until 1979, gave up power to a civilian constitutionally elected government, democratic government, in 1979. In 1983, Buhari decided to oust that government militarily. And to me, that was treason. That should have been punished by a firing squad. But When Babangida came in and ousted him in 1985, nothing was done to him, you know. So for him to be the so-called Democrat, I have no belief that he is a Democrat already. His party have been threatening journalists with arrest already, you know, and people expressing the opinion, they are being threatened with arrest. So that doesn't augur well for a president who says that he has changed, he is now a born-again Democrat. You know,
I was monitoring the reaction of Buhari's election in the financial sector. They seem to be very, very pleased with it, that Buhari has come to power. They believe that a strong man, a strong leader, will put the economy back on its footing, Nigeria being the largest economy in the continent, that you know, things will pick up and business will be on the right track with under Buhari. And all the more reason, I think, too, because he was trained militarily in the United States. There's a feeling within the diplomatic world that the business community having a stronger interest now in what is going on in Nigeria under his leadership, he will contain the terror and terrorism that have plagued Nigeria, and that he could be counted on to maintain a handle, quote unquote, on Nigeria in ways that Jonathan did not. What do you think about that?
Well, I am very happy that the stock market seems to have rebounded, but, you know, to me, it's going to be a short marriage, you know, because he's coming in at a time when oil prices are down. You know, I mean, even though Nigeria still maintains a hefty, I believe, $36 billion foreign reserve, it's going to be difficult for him to, as some of the Nigerian media is already speculating, whether he promised more than he can deliver, you know. So he can. I mean, there is only so much that he could fight corruption. But the thing is that you trees, when you look at the people who put together those parties that came into combine, they are just as corrupt or even more corrupt, you know, than the others, most of the people moved from the so-called corrupt PDP, People's Democratic Party. They moved to the APC, the All Progressives Congress. So what is going to happen? Is Buhari going to investigate these people? He has already said he is not. He is not going to let them account for their ill-gotten gains. After all, they used it in supporting his administration. I mean, his election. After all, River State is the richest state in the country. The governor left PDP to join APC. Now, there is a lot of money that has been missing in River State. And Buhari has said he's not going to investigate anybody. I mean, which is good. I don't believe in new governments always coming in and instead of carrying out the mandate of the people, they spend all their years in office investigating the opposition. So I doubt that corruption will be totally wiped out. We have to remember that, you know, when Buhari was the chairman of the Petroleum Commission, NNPC, $2 billion missed and has never been accounted for up to now. You know, it's just like Obasanjo proclaiming himself a corruption fighter. When he came out as his disciple, El-Rufai said when he came out from prison, he had 28,000 naira which is less than $200. Now, Obasanjo, after 8 years in office, is a multi-billionaire. So, that, you know, that doesn't add up. So, as I said, I am wishing that Buhari will succeed, because his success is for the benefits of all Nigerians and Africans as a whole. Because the, as Nigeria goes, so goes Africa. This is why Africans have held the election and are hoping that what Jonathan did will rub off on other leaders, on such leaders like the Cameroonian leader, Biya, who has been in office for 34 years and always holding these sham elections, you know, and also Mugabe. I mean, you know, all those people. You have the Santos in Angola. You have Jammeh. You have Equatorial Guinea, Obiang, Nguesso, Maso Mbasogi. You have all of them. So we are hoping that what Jonathan did could rub off on other African leaders. It's not that he is the first to do it. We had Abdoulaye Wade. He did the same thing in 2012 when he conceded to Macky Sall. I mean, Macky Sall.
That's in Senegal.
And we had the same thing with Rupia Banda in Zambia, who in 2011 conceded to Michael Sata. But it is the impact of what Jonathan did in Nigeria, where everybody had expected the same type of election result, whereby you know, I mean, before Jonathan came in, we had ballot boxes in the bush. People just threw them out and then put figures of what they wanted and won the election. Even Yar'Adua himself said the election that brought him in was tainted. There were irregularities. But the 2011 election was the first that international community said was the first election that seemed fair in Nigeria.
Well, today, President-elect Buhari is assembling his transition team and beginning the process of selecting members of his cabinet. What would, as we close, what would Buhari do to persuade you in this particular period, as he chooses his leadership team? What would you say would be a good indicator that he is parting ways with his past?
Well, he will. Of course, you have to understand that the Nigerian Constitution makes it mandatory that each of the 36 states must be represented in the cabinet. It doesn't matter whether the people voted for him or not, whether that state voted for him or not, they will have to have a representative in the cabinet. But it is the kind of people he selects that will indicate the kind of government that he is going to run, whether he is just going to reward his party people, those in his party, with ministerial appointments, or go outside the party, and like Jonathan, when you look at Jonathan's administration, even today, one of the articles in the Wall Street Journal praised Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, who is not a politician. We have Nganga, who is not a politician. We have the agricultural minister, who everybody, the whole world, has been praising for what he has done in Nigeria to raise agricultural produce in the country. And the transportation sector, where the railroad had been abandoned for more than 30 years, but now people can go from Lagos, sit in a very nice railway cars, and go to all the way to Kano or go to Port Harcourt in the east. So you look at, they are not, these are areas that were not represented by politicians. They were technocrats who were brought in because of their expertise. So that is the kind of thing we will have to look at. As to whether, as I said, he just appoints people who were political hacks or people who are experts with no party affiliation.
Well, we have to leave it there for today, Dr. Onyani. I want to thank you so much for giving us this little introduction. And, of course, we'll be following this as it goes, and certainly by May the 29th, we will know what the beginnings of this new regime would look like. But I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
All righty. We'll take this break. When we come back, we'll be talking about police killings at an all-time high right after this.
Oh, I guess in discipline you, the Nigerian government you, them they talk you. My people are useless, my people are senseless, my people are in discipline. The Nigerian government, you, them they talk me that. My people are useless, my people are senseless, my people are in discipline. I never heard that before. Make government talk you. My people are useless, my people are senseless, my people are in discipline. The Nigerian government, you, them they talk me that. Which kind talk be that you? Now Chris talk be that you? The animal talk be that you? The animal talk be that you?
You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Eutrice Lead. In March alone, 111 people, most of them unarmed and men of color, were killed by police, according to the American Civil Liberties Union. 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Department of Justice said that Philadelphia police had shot and killed 400 people in the span of 7 years, and that 80% of them were African Americans. These and other statistics confirm an extremely disturbing pattern. And we will discuss that today with our guest, Michael Grays, co-founder of 100 Blacks in Law Enforcement Who Care, and co-host of Community Cop on the Manhattan Neighborhood Network. And he's also a former law enforcement officer. I want to talk to you, Michael Grays, about this report, what it indicates, but in a sense, I know that You know this already. We just, the fact that the figures have been added to what we know is, of course, a bit new, but we've seen these patterns. But before anything else, thank you for joining us today. I have to, I can't forget my manners here.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Sister Eutrice, and it's an honor to be on your program.
Thank you for having the courtesy to be here today, too. Now, these figures are alarming in themselves, but in a sense, not really, because I imagine there's an innate sense of this trend that has you have observed over your years. What do you think about these numbers now that have come up and been added to the trend that we know, that we've observed, just covering these cases, in my situation, and in your situation, being in the thick of it?
Well, I would say that on the one hand, it's business as usual. Nothing has truly changed other than the advent of cameras, what have you, that can record some of these incendiary incidents. I think on the other hand that the reason why it's business as usual is because present-day mayors, district attorney offices, I dare say the government in general, has always been tolerant and perhaps condoning to such a great degree. Even the Justice Department itself justifies this. The Justice Department has never forced major police departments or smaller police departments to give up their numbers relative to how many individuals are being killed, how many black individuals are being killed, were they armed and unarmed, what is the police record, what is the folder of these police officers who are in particular, I'll just call them questionable because they're not questionable because they're not being questioned by superior officers. So I would say that that is very troubling when you look at the fact that they can get air cover from federal agencies, and certainly they can get air cover from local agencies. So it puts the black community at a distinct loss, and it can truly exploit our lack of organization and not lack of information, because we know. So if you look at the Ferguson study or other studies, the average brother on the corner can tell you that it's happening. He might not express it in an erudite manner, but he can tell you what's going on. The people in Ferguson, who many of us have been in communication with, has been saying these things all along. So when the stats came out about the racketeering that's going on in Ferguson, where they should all be hit with RICO statutes, it was not surprising to any of us, because all the surrounding areas around Ferguson, the six major police departments that surround the Ferguson community, they're all involved in racketeering. So I would just say that that we need to concentrate on to become mayors, to take over police departments. We certainly have to concentrate even more on becoming district attorneys all over America, and do that inglorious work for justice, because if we continue to just argue over who's a Democrat or Republican, Obama and all this other crap, we will find ourselves 10, 20 years from now, the numbers will be the same or worse, and we'll still be in the same condition. So we have to organize on so many levels. We have to get all of these jackrabbits out of office that just allow these things to go on and just continue to tell us there's nothing they can do about it. So we just put in a very repressive mayor who, and here in New York City in particular, who is supposed to be, who has been characterized by Reverend Sharpton as the most progressive mayor in the last 50, 60 years. But if he's progressive, compared to who? Frank Rizzo? So I'm just saying for the record that we're in dire straits. And again, those numbers as troubling as they are, Utrice, they are not anywhere near accurate because they don't have to be. That's why I'm saying that. They do not have to be. The NYPD can tell you, if they wanted to, how many black men have been killed as a result of police fire or use of force. In general, they can give you those numbers off. They can tell you how many white cops shot black cops over the last 50, 60, 70 years. Because there are no black cops to shoot white cops, and 100 blacks, we always say, white cops shoot black cops don't shoot white cops, and white cops don't shoot white cops. So I'm going to say it again so you'll get it. White cops shoot black cops don't shoot white cops, and white cops don't shoot white cops. So white cops are not shot. So the NYPD has never given up those numbers. Would never, we don't even have courageous journalists that would even ask them to give up those numbers. So, and that would be the same in LAPD, Chicago, and we know Philadelphia ain't giving up nothing. So these police departments, they're not out of control. People say they're out of control. They're who they are. You know, it's just that they do all this under mayors who allow it for whatever reason, even if it was Nutter in Philly or whether when it was good there, even under black mayors. Philly has demonstrated and made itself distinct by being so heavy-handed when it comes to black folks, and certainly LAPD and all the major ones, NYPD and the like. And if you saw by chance that last video in that we showed it on Community Cop last week in Inkster, Michigan, not Detroit, which is heavy-handed also, but Inkster, Michigan, with Floyd Dent, you would see a young black man walking out of his house with his mother. And, yes, he had mental problems, and he just had a screwdriver, a small screwdriver, in his hand, and his mother wasn't paying attention. He just happened to have it in his hand, and he was in la-la land walking out of his door, and the police officers, after saying, drop it, opened fire so quick on him and unloaded all of these rounds in his body, and there hasn't been anything done. So I'm just saying, when you see things like that, when you see a Zimmerman who can kill Trayvon Martin, and he's not even a police officer, no law enforcement, and if he can kill him outright after being instructed by a PAA, by an operator, a phone operator, telling him to stand down, and he still proceeded and killed Trayvon Martin, and then he doesn't, he's not found guilty of anything. It was just a trial because he wasn't a police officer, and the people in Sanford raised a lot of sand. So there was a trial, at least in that case, but he was exonerated, and there was no real prosecution, no vigorous prosecution of Zimmerman. And so the this is a message that goes across the entire country, Utrice, to wrap it up. These messages are being sent all over the country. When you see a clear case like what happened to Garner, and the federal government doesn't come in, eight cops surrounded Garner. Garner never threw a punch, never got into a boxing stand, nothing, begging for his life. His life is being sucked out of his body. He never once retaliated in any kind of way. And yet the federal government doesn't come in, and they have the temerity to argue why they can't come in that case, why they can't come in Ferguson, instead of just indicting people, instead of impaneling at least a grand jury, and starting the indictment process, and then come back with a true bill. They're not even trying it. They're arguing against themselves that they can't do it. So I'm just saying that we are in a state that is so troubling, and the summer's not even here yet. So I would just say that we're in a lot of serious trouble, Sister Utrice.
The numbers are just mind-boggling. In any other community, this would be considered beyond alarming. It would be considered beyond crisis. This would cause the nation to stop and say, there is something dramatically wrong here. I mean, in one city, 400 people killed over a seven-year period. Statistically, this is just incredible.
For the size of Philadelphia, given its history, these are the Cubs grown up of Frank Rizzo. Frank Rizzo, I dare say, in modern history, is the most brutal police commissioner of all time. I know people thinking names like Bull Connor and Sheriff Clark and all of them. Those are children compared to Frank Rizzo. Frank Rizzo in a major city hated black people so much that he did, you can read an article on Frank Rizzo when he watched some black demonstrators demonstrating at a rally, and he told the press, I can't wait till these cameras move away so we can start splitting their heads. I mean, that's how vicious and brutal he was. And he rose to the rank of mayor, by the way. He went through every rank, and he was the first captain to give black police officers a patrol car because all black cops in Philadelphia was on foot all those years until he made captain. And to show how gracious he was and just the kind of guy he was, He let black cops ride around in police cars instead of freezing their tails off in those vicious winters. And that was just a gesture on his part, but he has always been brutal and vicious, and everyone who's going on since then to high rank in that police department has followed suit. That's why you have what happened with MOVE. That's why you have what happened with MOMIA. That's why you have the present state of all these shootings, because this tone was set 50 years ago by Frank Rizzo, the police officer, and then the sergeant, the lieutenant, the captain, and all. He set a standard that really no other police officer, no other police department has been able to reach.
Do you know, I mean, 100 blacks in law enforcement, who care, the Latino Officers Association and other groups like that have consistently been discussing these things. Are you aware within the law enforcement community of any movement at all where people are saying, listen, all things aside, these numbers, we can't ignore these numbers and what they're supposed to, what they are telling us and what we're supposed to do about them. We ought to press for some kind of, what is the solution? But they ought to at least raise the question that it can't be accepted that these are just numbers and, well, you know, it's unfortunate, but life goes on kind of thing. Is there, in your awareness of any movement within the law enforcement community that says, look, folks, we have to police ourselves. These figures are telling us over and over and over again that we are in the middle of a problem, and B, that we are, in large measure, the problem.
We have had meetings with police commissioners, 100 blacks in law enforcement. We have had meetings with district attorneys, literally all of them. We have met with them at one time or another, pleading our case for them to prosecute. Even back in the days of the 48 hours and all this other stuff, we have always pleaded our case. We became extremely vociferous on this when Police Officer Omar Edwards was killed. He was killed in plain sight. They ran off all the witnesses who saw it on 125th Street and 2nd Avenue, ran them off, intimidated all of them, and took all of the cameras. It was at least 4 to 5 cameras that had that information of him being shot. They went on record, the police commissioner and the mayor, the next day, and said Omar Edwards was shot in the chest when he was facing Officer Dutton face-to-face with their guns out. There was no evidence ever that Omar Edwards ever pulled his gun out. Furthermore, we found out later that Omar Edwards was shot in the back. Now, Raymond Kelly, who was a 40-year police officer, knows full well the difference in an entrance wound and an exit wound.
He was a former police commissioner, just needed to say that.
Yes, he's a former police chief, former police commissioner of New York City, which he did twice under two different mayors. One was a black mayor, and then under Michael Bloomberg for 12 years. And he knows full well what the difference is. He had that information as to how he got shot. It was just an ugly case. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office knows it was dirty. We told every black journalist, we wrote all the city council people at that time, wrote state senators, assembly people. None of them will come and deal with this situation. We got a little bit of dialogue from Perkins, but he would not touch it because none of them were going to mess with Morgenthau. And Morgenthau was the most powerful district attorney in the country. And that office still is, by the way, with his handpicked person, Cyrus Vance, who let DSK go from, you know, after raping a black woman. So I'm just saying that there's a clear history there. We've pleaded to journalists, so-called journalists, here in New York, the black ones, they all went running. They all went for a rock to hide under, and we pleaded our case. Now, I've even heard a few of them say on the radio with the Omar Edwards case, Omar Edwards was shot in the back. They say that 4 or 5 years later. Now they can say, oh, well, we remember that case. But when the case was current, they all ignored it. So I'm just saying it's extremely hard when you as an organization, you plead to your people, you plead to elected officials, journalists, and the like, and you go around to district attorney's offices, and you have meetings with them and try to get them to indict these police officers just outright kill our people. But you know, it's a tough road to hoe, you know.
So what is going to happen? The systems that are supposed to kick in, because this is supposed to be the work of the FBI, they're supposed to be gathering this information, the U.S. Justice Department is supposed to be on top of this, and clearly the trend, it's disturbing on any level. So if they're not doing the work that's supposed to be done, if they're not proceeding with investigations, vigorous investigations and prosecutions and so forth, if the police commissioners are not doing what they call reform, then what is happening? How is this going to be solved?
Well, as we speak right now, supposedly the president's task force is supposed to be going to major police forces all around the country to ask them for their stats, to encourage them on a what-to-do list. You are not going to come from the federal government and passively tell New York City you recommend that they start getting out of their car speaking to black people. All this silliness of this task force, who, by the way, the guy who heads it is currently right now was the police chief in Philadelphia.
Where the 400 people had been shot. So
he's supposed to be getting these stats, encouraging a what-to-do list for these major police departments, and he's a heavy-handed, brutal killer of black people also. And he's a black man, by the way, who came up in that Philly system. So I would just say that we are in dire straits because the police, because the president, who knows full well what he should do, and he knows what the Justice Department can force police departments can do, they're not doing, but they give us the lip service that this is being done, but it doesn't have teeth in it. When you see what that task force recommendations are, it lacks teeth, and when you see clear racketeering that's going on in Ferguson. They haven't even done anything to Ferguson, which would send a good signal. If they indicted clerks, city manager, the mayor, police commissioner, and all of these people that are stepping down can still be indicted. They should all be indicted. They should all be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. You've never seen that type of racketeering on paper anywhere in America. And all of those surrounding police departments, six of them in particular, are all doing the same thing to black folks. And the Justice Department has that information and won't move with it. And so if Eric Holder wanted to do something to redeem himself, he should come down on them heavy-handed, and then Loretta Lynch would get in right away, who's not in the, you know, who's not going to do anything anyway. But what's happened in the Eastern District here in New York State, you know, which she's been in control of for years, she hasn't done anything with it. But Eric Holder could at least redeem himself with Sean Bell and all these other cases that he's ignored if he at least did Ferguson right away and did Philly right away and did New York right away. At least if he did Philly, New York, and Ferguson, at least he can go out saying that he did something.
Well, we leave it right there today, Michael Grace. Thank you so much for being with us today and giving us an insight from the inside of how these things, these are, you know, to the public, their numbers, to the individuals and their families, of course, it's a lot of pain. And yes, to anyone remotely interested in justice, this is cause for an all-out assault, this a frontal assault on this problem. And it has been, of course, going on for years and years and years. And the systems that are supposed to respond and do something about it, as you just pointed out, they're not doing anything about it except, you know, issuing reports and flapping their lips. But we don't see any prosecutions. We don't see people really being made to account for the atrocities that they commit, the departments that are doing these things, the police officers that are doing these things. It's not happening. And so the people ask, well, if the system that is empowered to do something isn't doing it, and we aren't allowed to do anything about it, it seems as if what they're encouraging is a point at which there would be just explosions that they can't control. Thanks so much for being with us today, Michael Grace.
Thank you very much, Utrice, and let's get rid of some of these gatekeepers in the process.
Okay. Thank you. That brings us to the end of our program today. I hope you found it of value. You let me know, of course, at leadstories@gmail.com or leadstories with Utrice Lead on Facebook. Stay tuned. Keep it right here. The Infectious Myth with David Crow is up next. And we'll see each other tomorrow. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company.
Human beings, animal talk, don't start again. Dash them, human rights. Them go all me to you, them go start yap human beings. Animal talk, don't start again. Dash them. Human rights. How animal gonna say the double?